Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Last week, the International Journalism Festival in Perugia once again brought so many compelling conversations from around the media industry to the table. One topic was especially stark. Generative AI has been the dominant conversation since it burst onto the scene in late 2022, marked by the arrival of ChatGPT. OpenAI's chatbot quickly became a sensation for its ability to handle a wide range of tasks, from a simple search query or a large volume of text. But for newsrooms, generative AI has brought a slew of headaches. How do they use this new fancy tech and what for? Is it providing users with accurate information when their algorithms are such carefully guarded secrets? And crucially, are these big tech platforms stealing news content to train their models, and are news organizations owed some money? These questions and more were pored over in Perugia, and today we attempt to bring you some of the highlights and key talking points. Strap in, all that's coming up, so don't go anywhere. So, where do we even start with AI? Well, what even is AI? Here's a useful explainer from data journalist Meredith Broussard, an associate professor at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute of New York University.
So what's happening with generative AI is exactly the same as what's happening in other machine learning systems, right? So AI is a pretty broad field and has different subfields. We've got machine learning, we've got neural nets, we've got natural language generation, natural language processing, expert systems. But machine learning is the one that's most popular right now. And so generally when people say AI right now, they mean machine learning, right? So what happens when we make a machine learning system? Well, we take a whole bunch of data and we dump it into the computer. And we say, computer, make a model. Computer says, okay, it makes a model, and the model shows the mathematical patterns in the data. And then we can use that model to do all kinds of cool things, like make decisions, or make predictions, or generate new text, or images, or audio, or video, right? So what a generative AI system is doing when it's generating, say, new text, is it's doing something called next token prediction. Every word is a token, and it's predicting what is statistically the most likely next word in a sequence. So it's not thinking, it's not trying to communicate anything about the world, it's not trying to make sense in the way that a human being would, it's just predicting what is the statistically most likely next token, which is really cool, but is not transformative in the way that people usually expect.
Generative AI tools, unlike AI models of the past, are both easier and more affordable to use than before. These historically have been reserved for highly expensive and specialist data teams. That's all changed with generative AI, and part of the reason why 90% of content on the internet is predicted to be synthetic in the next 2 years, according to research by the European law enforcement group, Europol. The trouble is, we don't know much about the training data behind this content. OpenAI does not disclose what data is used to train ChatGPT, but Google does, and the Washington Post recently did some digging into its C4 database, which contains 15 million websites that are used to inform its chatbot Gemini, formerly Bard, and there's all sorts of proprietary and dodgy information in the mix. The category of news and media ranks as the third most prevalent source of data. Half of the top 10 sites were news websites, like the Huffington Post, Forbes, Guardian, LA Times, and the New York Times. However, it also includes poorly trusted sites like Russian state-owned RT, far-right opinion site Breitbart, and anti-immigration VDare.com associated with white supremacy. Oh, and by the way, Wikipedia was also the second highest sourced website. So when you consider that AI works on probabilities, and the data used to determine that is questionable at times, you can start to understand why there is such a concern about the use of these models. Here's Julia Angwin, founder of Proof News, and before that, The Markup, for more on that.
The way that they're you described it, right, they create like a plausible next token, the next word, etc. They are not designed for accuracy. They are explicitly have warnings, like don't, you know, nothing in this answer is accurate. So the question I have is, why do we call it artificial intelligence? Like, if I went out and marketed a product called intelligence, and then everything that it said was likely untrue, I feel like we have to question that assumption entirely as part of the answer to that question, because it may not be about biasing, debiasing. It may be more that we need to understand that these systems are just weirdo, I like to call them poetry bots. They're really good at poetry. If you want a poem, they will make you a nice limerick or a haiku, whatever you want, a sonnet. And so maybe we need to rethink what they are for.
So artificial intelligence might not be all that intelligent after all. It's certainly not neutral or unbiased either. There's a real ethical question on journalists' hands about how they engage with this tech, knowing this. A recent study by the University of Amsterdam, together with the Associated Press, found that the most common strategy to ethically use AI is just not to use it. That's 1 in 5 in a study of 300 journalists. Here's Natalie Hurlburger from the University of Amsterdam on that point.
The fact is that a lot of media organizations are not making their own LLMs, but they're fine-tuning existing models or using other models. So you want the tools you use to be safe and trustworthy. And in a recent study we did together with the Associated Press, we found that by far the most prevalent response to address concerns about reliable technology was not to use the technology. So there you can already see how taking away some of these ethical and legal issues can actually be good for innovation. So the role of regulation is therefore to make these tools trustworthy and reliable. As to the question of who should regulate, that is a good, important question, and I totally take your point also about the potential abuse of regulation. So the way the European Union is trying to do that with the AI Act is to lay down a baseline regulation, but also impose a lot of responsibility, especially on the media sector, to go further and self-regulate and ensure that the technologies that you're using, that you use that in a responsible way. Because in the end, it's not a problem that can be solved by switching a switch here or switching it here. It's really a cooperative responsibility to make sure that these tools are reliable and trustworthy.
So what's the alternative? When it comes to overcoming the ethical challenges of using AI, journalists are either mostly verifying the output themselves or looking to other guidelines and legal frameworks. And there is some movement here. Newsrooms are adopting their own internal guidelines slowly and surely. Meanwhile, Reporters Sans Frontières recently came up with their own Paris Charter on AI and journalism, together with 16 partner organisations, the first benchmark of its kind to outline 10 principles for ethical use of AI within journalism. As we heard there, the other proposal is regulation. The EU and the US are all looking into this space closely, aiming to make AI systems more safe, transparent, traceable, and non-discriminatory. Here's Emily Bell, director of the Tau Centre for Digital Journalism in the US, on why this is needed for the news industry.
We very clearly need regulation of AI, and I think you're seeing that through, certainly sort of Europe is moving quickly on this, China has moved very quickly on this, America is beginning to move on this. Why do we need to regulate it? And from a news perspective, obviously there's an interesting issue in the United States about freedom of First Amendment and how you implement AI in the newsroom. We had a fascinating session on that at Columbia a little while ago, which is highly technical issues of who should have access to the data, how should it be used, what's freedom of expression, what's right to hear, how do we hash all of these things out. In the news, I think that there's a level of regulation at every point of use. So you need consumer regulation to protect consumers. You need newsroom self-regulation, I think, in terms of being very explicit about the policies that you implement. I mean, one of the reasons we need it just in a very sort of simple, straightforward way is that I think journalism is being really challenged in a way which is, you know, we've seen it very vividly in the United States in the first 3 months of this year with something like sort of 2,000-3,000 jobs just disappearing off an already, you know, very low job base. I think if we want to be in these rooms in the years to come, we have to have an equitable playing field for the new wave of technologies. I think we've learned a lot in the past 20 years about what bad relationships with technology companies look like, and I think regulation will actually help us get there.
However, she also says, be careful what you wish for. You don't want authoritarian regimes dictating regulation.
I had exiled Russian journalists come to my information warfare reporting class and demonstrate to my students a Russian bot, which is active as a chatbot, AI-powered chatbot on Telegram, where you can ask it for the identity. You put in anybody's name who's a Russian citizen, and it will spit out at you every single record, medical, financial, address, like just a level of personal data that is absolutely horrifying. And he was like, this is what you have when you have a completely corrupt system where you have regulation that's not properly, that's not actually kind of implemented, where the system is so corrupt that people just sell data, where there's no punishment for it. You know, we have a very privileged view of like nice regulation that works perfectly for everywhere, but there's a ton of examples out there of where there is no regulation, where it's corrupt.
Ritu Kapoor, co-founder and managing director of The Quint, echoes this for her market in India as well.
I'm a little wary to say that governments should come up with this regulation, individual governments, because there's a conflict there, right? Because, for instance, during elections right now, governments are using AI for their campaigns, for personalized communication with the voters, including deepfakes, which may or may not be used maliciously, but the use of deepfakes is being used. So any regulation that comes from an entity that is using AI for their own agenda will be very skewed, right? I'll give you an example. I'm sure you guys have read about it. In February this year, somebody in India prompted Gemini to say whether Modi is a fascist ruler, or, you know, whether his government is fascist. And Gemini came up with this response which said that as per the policies, on dissent and you know, the Hindu nationalism, etc., some experts would characterize Modi's policies as fascist. Now, that led, you know, led to a huge, I mean, that exploded things. And the IT minister came down with a sledgehammer regulation saying that any LLM, any AI modeling, any software using AI will all necessarily have to get the explicit approval of the government to be able to go through. Now, that kind of regulation is worrisome. Yeah.
Reporters Sans Frontier also identifies three ways in which AI is posing threats to journalism. As discussed, one is the blurring lines between fact and fiction, and another is access to a shared information landscape. But the third factor is disruption to the business model. It's the basis of an ongoing lawsuit between the New York Times and Microsoft's OpenAI, where the news organization claims millions of its articles are being used without permission or remuneration to train chatbots. However, according to Anya Shriffin, director of the Technology and Media Specialization at Columbia University, the tech companies are trying to find ways around the copyright claims now.
My friends in Silicon Valley tell me that these companies have already hired journalists to rewrite the stories, right? So they don't have to pay for it. And that's part of the New York Times lawsuit, was that the stories were changed with one or two words. Or worse, OpenAI gave back stories that they said were from the New York Times that weren't even true. So that erodes the brand.
Microsoft, however, did enter into an industry-first partnership with Axel Springer at the end of last year to pay the German news group for news content to train its LLMs and to upserve news articles into search results. News deals are on the table, and we go back to Emily Bell for the two kinds being explored.
The deals basically break down into two types, one of which is the more hardball deal about how much money are you going to pay us for our archives. So you'll see that the New York Times is taking on Microsoft in the courts, to try and enforce higher payments or to extract fair value. The New York Times is also, I think, what we'd broadly call the Google newsroom. It has a lot of Google technology and a lot of Google kind of support within it. And this is not something they would deny. I was talking to A.G. Sulzberger about this the other day in public, and he was like, yeah, it's fair. So what we're seeing is a set of deals with Microsoft and the whole Axel Springer deal is, I think, symptomatic of that. And then there are the deals which are We'll give you $5 million. You can collaborate with OpenAI on how we build tools and things like that, which are very useful for small newsrooms and very kind of tempting deals, and honestly, in some cases, deals that newsrooms, or rather offers, grants that newsrooms and research organisations find hard to turn down, because there isn't a lot of money out there for kind of innovation in news, etc. And there is a real sort of get on board, don't miss the train. Well, I'm sad, I'm here to tell you I'm old enough that I remember when the train left the station last time with lots of publishers on it, and it was on the wrong train, and it would have been a lot better if they'd actually missed it.
So partnerships are possible, and many are hoping the Axel Springer deal will pave the way for more deals like it. But some news organisations are proving they can go at it alone and develop their own generative AI tools. For instance, Chris Morin, head of editorial innovation at The Guardian, revealed its Guillemot prompt management system.
And it struck me that the thing I needed to do was start throwing journalistic use cases at the LLM to see what it could do. And fundamentally, I realised that I was doing the same thing over and over again. I was copying and pasting a Guardian article and shoving it into the LLM underneath a prompt that I'd written. So I went to Joe, who was at that time the only engineer working on this, and I said, I'd really like you to make that easier for me. I want to be able to experiment with prompting. And what I'm about to show you is not a tech powerhouse. It's really simple tech, but I think instructive in terms of the way that we've approached it. Basically, it is a Chrome extension attached to a back end. And whenever I go to a Guardian article, I can click it, and then I can execute one of a bunch of prompts that I have written and refined over the last year. And it immediately made it much more easy for me to start understanding the edges of this technology. If you're working within a context that you understand and you're trying to prompt it to do something, then you're quite well placed to judge the output and whether or not you're going in the right direction. And the thing that struck me as well was, if it was useful for me to experiment with, then it was also going to be useful possibly for people in the newsroom to experiment with, but crucially for me to be able to show those people how it worked as well and get their feedback. So in effect, we ended up creating a kind of experimental playground and what you might call a prompt management system.
There was also the Associated Press that released their own generative AI search tool, Merlin, to understand concepts and discern subtle differences in similar photos. Here's executive editor Julie Pace.
Merlin is our AI, Gen AI search tool. And we started testing this last year, and we have now rolled this out within our own newsroom to allow our journalists to be able to search our content more quickly. But we've also rolled it out to our customers to allow them to search our content more quickly. What we've found is that AI-generated search is just better able to understand concepts. So when you type words into a search bar, you know, you're used to getting some things that really kind of meet the mark and some things that feel a little bit off. What Gen AI can do is it can actually really discern those concepts in a more high-level way.
She also said that as long as the right standards are in place, she definitely sees a future where AI is a standard routine for things like automating earning reports or sports scores. But sticking with the sports theme, the tech is capable of big errors, says Charlie Beckett, the director of Polis at the London School of Economics.
This is from Sports Illustrated, who had the genius idea of using generative AI to write stories. Loads of the stories were inaccurate and mistaken and had to be corrected or even taken down. It was an editorial disaster. Stupidity upon stupidity, though, they also used AI to create fake journalists with fake bylines and fake photos. These people do not exist. So I think they made just about every mistake. Now, the important thing here is that it was the humans that made the mistakes. They used the wrong AI, they used it in the wrong way, and they didn't take all the usual precautions to maintain editorial standards. And I think that's important. Yes, there are inherent risks around this technology. You're all familiar with its tendency to contain biases. It can be inaccurate. It's a language machine. It's not a truth machine. But it's humans that decide to use it badly.
However, there was a notable word of caution too, that AI puts the pressure on journalists in the newsroom. Freelancers, for instance, have lost work opportunities, says Anna Cudrea-Rado.
I'll preface this with this story happened outside of journalism. So even though I was hired in for this freelance gig because I'm a journalist and was very reliant on my journalistic skills, this happened outside of a traditional media organization, outside of a newsroom. But I was hired to work on a newsletter. So one of my specialisms is newsletter writing. I was hired to work on a newsletter which was curated links from articles with a little blurb about each one and then the link. And we did a couple of issues of the newsletter, and then the person that I was working for, was a client because it was a freelance gig, they said, oh, I think we could probably use AI to help with this. But don't worry, this is going to be great because it's going to free you up to do bigger projects, and we're going to be able to get you to do some longer reported pieces and really use your journalism skills. And I actually did kind of watch as the AI systems were being implemented, and I was actually able to see kind of like what that actually looks like. But lo and behold, budgets changed. And not only did the longer and more in-depth pieces not come to anything, I also was replaced by the robot. So it was my first experience of kind of like living, I suppose, this thing that a lot of people are worried about happening, which is having a job quite literally be taken by the robot. But on the other hand, I suppose to kind of just like put more of a positive spin on it, this isn't the first time that technology has in some way impacted a job loss for me. I actually went freelance because of redundancy, which was during a pivot to video. So, these things do happen. But, a robot took my job.
And journalists might find themselves measured by their new robot counterparts, according to Dhruv Mehrotra, investigative data reporter at Wired.
Well, in the short term, I'm worried about especially sort of private equity-run newsrooms and how management there will sort of see these perceived productivity benefits from generative AI and kind of force unreasonable extra work on news workers, right? Like, that's my first concern kind of now, having worked in several digital newsrooms.
Of course, AI tools have their upsides for journalists too. We've explored that. But it's also worth noting that journalism isn't the only sector and profession that's been disrupted. Book authors, museums, universities, they've all been affected too. And so solutions to move forward may need to consider or indeed collaborate with other fields. In fact, that might make more sense coming back to Charlie Beckett, who says that news publishers have a poor track record of working together.
Advertisers have no obligation whatsoever to support journalism, and we would be mugs to expect that can be reclaimed somehow. Yes, great if we can negotiate to try and get money, although I think from what I've seen from talking to publishers, the idea that they're going to work collaboratively for the good of the whole industry and small publishers in particular is a fantasy. Mm-hmm. News publishers have never collaborated on anything. The idea that they're going to somehow fall into line, we can see already that they've broken ranks. You know, people are going on their own way to try and negotiate or sue. And, in some ways, good luck. I mean, if they can get any money, that's good. Journalism needs it.
However, he says there are still massive opportunities to gain from AI through the entire news chain, news gathering, production and distribution. However, is this too myopic of a view? Can we dare to think bigger and bolder? Do we need to consider the information landscape more broadly? A lot of the examples we've talked about today could neatly be put into the efficiency phase of generative AI. This is the first 2 years of the tech being on the scene, says David Caswell, founder of the innovation consultancy Storyflow and a former executive product manager at BBC News Labs in a role focused on AI-based initiatives.
Most news organizations that I interact with are well, I think, well prepared for this phase of AI that is about efficiency on the existing workflow. I see a lot of initiatives, I see budgets being allocated, I see even organizational structures being tweaked and tuned. I see training, I see infrastructure being built. This is a self-selected set, but still. So I have been surprised at how well the news industry that I see is adapting to this efficiency phase. But I am very worried about the news industry's ability to adapt to this new information ecosystem. I also have a fair amount of contact with startups and others in the tech world. I kind of come from the tech world. I was at Yahoo, and before that I had a tech company. And I see a lot of initiatives happening there, including quite radical initiatives that, if successful, and most of them will not be successful, but if successful, would fundamentally restructure how information flows through societies. And the thing that's most in my mind is that, you know, if we're going to move into this new AI-mediated information ecosystem, I think it's inevitable, then how do we bring the values of journalism in there? We might not be able to bring a lot of journalism into that new ecosystem, but I think it's critical for all of us that the values of journalism, you know, accuracy, you know, the holding power to account, you know, the very fundamentals that they end up in that world too. And it's only by engaging, it's only by the news industry engaging with that developing new world that we're all so unsure about right now, that we have a good chance of moving, you know, moving the stuff that really matters from the old way of doing news to whatever this is that comes.
It's precisely here where news publishers have managed to find solid applications for pre-existing workflows, processes, and environments. But what if there are applications we haven't yet considered? His most recent project was the AI in Journalism Futures Challenge, a call out to robustly conceive and stress test where the future of AI is headed and how to prepare for those scenarios. 900 people submitted ideas for the challenge, and 40 of those were taken into a two-day scenario planning workshop earlier this month. A couple of key themes emerged, and some of those will sound familiar. Machines could become the ultimate intermediaries, eliminating many professions in the process. The information landscape could become completely flooded with bad content. A new power shift will emerge that will require a new type of regulation beyond even governments and international bodies. It's this final point, though, that's quite interesting. David's project partner Xu Wei Fang, Associate Director of Media and Disinformation at the Open Society Foundation, picks up on this. She says, AI is as much about power as the tech. And another big power shift to watch out for is the amount afforded to audiences.
The more sort of underlying power shift that we all sort of talked about in a scarily consensus-driven way during the workshop was the fundamental shift of power from producers to audience. So you think that audiences are in control now, it's going to be a completely different scale, you know, in this near-term future. Consumers being able to drive preferences, and with the caveats that, you know, social inequalities and others bring with them, but it will be that audiences will be able to control their own consumption experience.
Worryingly, some of the people on the project also foresaw a future where information inequality was growing between richer and poorer audiences. Some were very dystopian and radical, predicting that AI would ultimately have the agency to require its own rights and the ability to follow or break the governing rules of those rights. All of that, though, is more than 5 years into the future, and the focus for now would be to prepare for the next 2 to 5 years, which is where the tech industry is most focused on. And Chris Moran from The Guardian had a similar point of view.
I also think it's important to say that in 5 years' time, it is entirely possible that journalists will be doing amazing work and actively trying not to use this stuff. I also think it's possible that they will be using this stuff without necessarily realising that they're using it too.
So what do we make from all of this? Journalists need to get their hands dirty, not avoid it. We heard about that earlier on. This technology is not going anywhere, but it sure needs to get a lot better and more trustworthy. Otherwise, journalists will remain reluctant to get their hands, as mentioned, dirty. So how does it get better? Regulation? Potentially. But that's a can of worms and spans not only other sectors, but other countries. And looking ahead into the future, probably more broader than that. There is the pressure of lawsuits or the potential of partnerships, but maybe it's worth, as we wrap up here, reflecting on past attempts to try and reach a working relationship with tech platforms. And there's two insights on this that I love. The first from Ritu Kapoor of The Quint, who says we need to stop focusing on volume and potential and concentrate more on our mission as news organisations.
Newsrooms should not look at AI the way we did social media in terms of making everything large and huge in volume. I don't think anyone, including the audience that consumes news, wants more news or more information. I think if you can understand AI to be able to use tools to really further define and improve what your distinctive, differentiated offering is as a news product. That, and I think the third thing is, you've got to go slow. I think you've got to be open to innovation, you've got to learn technology, but I think, and I'm coming from a place where in 2015, I wanted every new shiny technology, every new candy in the store, because I didn't want to get left behind. I think that is something that we have to be careful about. I think one of the problems right now is that AI is on steroids at a time when elections, when there isn't enough technology to counter it in terms of protection of rights, of privacy, in terms of detection, in terms. So it's really out of sync. There's a lot of AI to be used, a lot of cheap, easy to use, free tools, which can, you know, you can produce content and videos at scale. There is no time to test it, and it's coming at a time when the information by governments, by campaigns, propaganda, everything is on overdrive. So this is a very, very tricky time. I think we're slightly lucky that in India, our elections have come slightly early. I think by the time the end of the year elections are happening, I can tell you, I'm a fact checker, I will not be able to detect a correct video from a deep fake video.
And the last one comes from Julie Pace at the Associated Press. Listen to this.
What happened to the industry at the kind of advent of the internet is a real lesson learned for people, you know, both because from a technology standpoint, we recognize we can't let this sit back and wash over us, right? We have to be players in this space. And I think that that is going to mean, I talk about this a lot in our newsroom, that is going to mean that we're going to make some mistakes. And it does mean we're going to try some things and they're not going to work and we're going to have to try new things. But we have to be engaged. We can't turn this over to technology companies if we want to survive this. So I think that's one crucial piece of it. I think the other is we are having that conversation about how does this support our business model or how does it change our business model and allow us to drive revenue in another way. And it's okay as newsrooms to talk about how you make money. It's okay to talk about yourself as a business. In fact, if you're not talking about yourself as a business, then you're probably not going to survive. Because as mission-driven as I am, as I think most of us are, you know, mission doesn't get you money, and mission doesn't pay the bills, and mission doesn't pay the salaries. So I think we don't know exactly what the revenue model will be, but the fact that it's part of this conversation in its infancy is, I think, a positive development.
I get the feeling we'll be talking about generative AI for a while, and I'd love to know what you made of today's conversation and your two cents on what lies in store for the media industry in this space. You can get in touch with me on LinkedIn, Twitter/X at JPGJournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can catch up with all the talks from Perugia on journalismfestival.com or head to their YouTube page instead. You can also catch up with all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.